Growing up on a farm for some time myself, I can surely tell you that there are no lack of stories and no lack of things to creep you out while being out on the farm. I myself lived on a rural farm out in the middle of nowhere. Welcome back to the swamp, my friends. It's good to see you made it back for another creepy video. Today we're going to be sharing some creepy, and allegedly true, farming horror stories sent in by viewers just like you. If you have a story that you would like to share in a future video, be sure to submit it at swampdweller.net or the email you can find in the description down below. I'd love to share your story with everyone here in the swamp. It's stories like yours that truly help keep this show going. Now, without further ado, let's get into these creepy and allegedly true farming horror stories. I have stories about both my farm and my boyfriend's farm that might be interesting to you and your show. Farms have a lot of history. My family has been farming in the exact same spot since the 1870s when my family arrived from Germany, and his family has been farming in the same area since the 1930s. Therefore, they have lots of tales and lots of history. My boyfriend's dad, I will call him my father-in-law because he basically is at this point, I swear has seen everything at least once, and has the most interesting stories. I will share a couple of his. For context, my boyfriend's family farms on both sides of the Iowa and Missouri border. Since they lived close to the state line, they have corn, soybeans, and beef cattle on pasture. I particularly love the cattle, because I love getting to jump in the Ranger and ride around the pasture with my boyfriend to check on the cows. We do this almost every single night in the spring, summer, and fall to make sure they are healthy, not injured, account for the calves, and make sure they have enough grass. We also look to see if there are any holes or breaks in the fences. In the wintertime, they get moved around to a lot with a covered shed to protect them from the elements, so they are not in the pasture, and we feed them hay. Anyway, in the mid-2000s, my father-in-law was out in the wooded area of the cattle pasture. The trees are quite dense here, and it often serves as a great deer hunting spot in the late fall and winter once the cows have been moved to the winter lot. He was setting up trail cameras in the woods to watch deer in preparation for hunting season that fall. After some time, he came back out to get the cart out of the camera to see if there were any big bucks roaming around the pasture. When he looked at some of the pictures, he saw that there had been an unusual man back there. Trespassers are not all that uncommon, and often it's just an annoyance rather than a cause for concern. There was no way to tell who it was, so he had just forgotten all about it. A few days later, though, he went back to hang the camera back up in the tree. When my father-in-law went back a second time, about a week or so later to get the camera to see the pictures, someone had dug three makeshift graves in the back corner of the pasture. At the head of each grave was a wooden cross with the first name on it. He, unfortunately, did not catch the man on the trail camera, but he alerted the police about the situation. I think based on the names on the crosses, the police had an idea of who it could have been. The rural Midwest is a lot smaller than you think for being so vast. My father-in-law was not sure what came of that, but he never really looked too much into it. But if he had not discovered those graves in that pasture and alerted the police, they might have been filled. And by who? We don't know. For the second story, my father-in-law had some farms in Missouri that were bordered by the Missouri River. The Missouri River flows down through the Dakotas, along the Iowa and Nebraska border, and then at Kansas City, it takes a turn and divides the state of Missouri in two until it reaches the Mississippi. One spring in the late 1990s, he was out in a field next to the Missouri River planting corn. This was before all the current high-tech tools that farmers have at their disposal now, which can tell you if you are having an issue with your machine right from the cab. He thought that his planter was having some issues, so he jumped out to check if something was broken, perhaps. When he got out of his tractor, he noticed a strange smell. It was a very bad smell. If you know anything about farming, planting season is a fast-paced time where you try to beat the weather. And he was more concerned about getting his crop planted than investigating. He just assumed it was a dead deer washed up in the river and continued up until he thought the planter was having problems again just a few hours later. This time he was at the end of the field closer to the river. The smell was stronger and unlike anything he had ever experienced before. They continued that day working until one of the hired men asked if anyone noticed the bizarre smell coming from the river. My father-in-law said he had and wondered maybe it was a dead deer or something. But usually deer did not stink quite like this. One of the hired men wandered across the field to the edge of the river. It's not like it's a nice sandy beach that touches the ground, like a shoreline. Often, it is a rocky or steep overlook many feet down to the river below. They were trying to get a closer look. At the bottom, he saw what he thought was an animal tangled up in the branches washed up by the river. Looking closer, he realized it was a person. They immediately called the police. Turns out it was a missing woman who was known as a prostitute from the Kansas City area who made it very far down the stream somehow. I cannot find the exact article or name, and I do not know if the police ever told my father-in-law her name, even though they briefly questioned him. But I do know there are a few articles of women being found in the river of East Kansas City in the late 1990s. Since the early 2000s, I had wanted my own small-scale farm. I think the popular term is a hobby farm. While I have no intention of having thousands of acres or a large herd of cattle, I am hoping to make a go of it year-round. Just this last year, I found 30 acres close to town. This specific parcel had been part of a larger farm, but was broken off for a member of the owner's family. The family member recently died, making way for my purchase. The house was in rather good shape, but the outbuildings had seen better days. I began the teardown immediately. With the help of some friends, I was able to get the barn completed in short order. I moved on to a second smaller storage building. The winter would slow our work. However, by late spring, the roof was all we had left. Most of it was completed when I had an accident. I was alone, putting on shingles, and lost my footing and fell. My arm was broken. The injury did not really stop me from working my real job. During the healing period, I took all the overtime I could. I had been avoiding it until then, but it is nice to have all the extra money. I plan on putting it towards supplies to build a chicken tractor and get some chickens. Unfortunately, during this time, I lost a family member of my own. He and I had been awfully close when I was growing up. Since my father spent much of his time on the road, his younger brother would need any help he could. Any major occasions my dad was unable to attend, my uncles always made sure to record it for him. It was a lot like having two dads. My mom also liked having him around. Most of her time was dedicated to my disabled sister. She feared I was not getting enough attention myself. You can see how important he had become to my family and myself. His loss has been extremely hard on me. I found myself brooding on his death more than I should have. Until this past week, when I made a disturbing discovery in the woodshop. My doctor had given me the all clear. The cast was off and I was free to get back to the farm work. My friends had finished shingling for me, so I moved on to my last job, a decent-sized building used for woodworking and carpentry. The benches were still in good shape. I disassembled and stored them. After a cursory inspection, I determined the frame was still solid. So I started by pulling up the floor. The boards from which it was made were rotten and full of holes. I made it about halfway when I found an old tin box under a loose board. It was square and about the size of a lunchbox. Inside, I discovered a few old trinkets and a stack of photographs. The trinkets included some rings, an old lighter, and even a metal barrette with a bow on it. The photos had been placed face down. I pulled out a stack and turned them over. Most of these images were of nude or partially clothed women. They looked to be from the 80s and 90s. Many were old and faded. As I flipped through, something struck me as odd about them. Soon, I realized what it was. None of the women were smiling. A lot looked scared, in fact. I began turning them over and discovered each had a name and a year written on the back. Myra, 1988. Sybil, 1991. Stephanie, 1983. I counted and found 42 in total. These are not your average dirty pictures. The models did not look pleased to be taking them. At that moment, a terrible idea popped into my head. I had seen something like this before. I had watched a documentary about a serial killer. The cops had found loads of pictures in his home. Many of the women had yet to be identified. I also remembered some killers like to keep objects from their victims. I pulled up a plain gold band out of the box. I turned it around until I saw a name engraved in the side. The name matched one of the women in the pictures. A terrified blonde from 1981. A shiver ripped through my body. Had I found a serial killer's photo stash? In the middle of Kansas, of all places? That is where my ideas seemed to fall flat. I did some research, and I could not find a killer active at that time. Not in this part of the state. Maybe I had jumped to conclusions and the pictures were not that bad. I recognized the possibility that these deaths occurred under the radar. It is simply hard to believe 42 women disappeared without anyone noticing. 42. That number still amazes me. But it was a time before DNA and cameras. It wouldn't be too crazy to see how anyone could get away with taking 42 people's lives and not be caught. My biggest problem with this whole theory, though, is... I don't know. How was he not caught? Likely, this was just some creep who kept his sex trophies under the floor of his woodshop. Maybe that is all. But what if... Frankly, I change my opinion every few minutes. I have sat on this box for over a week, unable to decide if I should go to the cops. Just last night I had a nightmare. A dirty old man killed a woman in front of me. I tried to tell people, but no one would listen. I woke up soaked in sweat and shaking. That was the last straw. I have decided that I'm going to give it to the cops tomorrow. What happens after that is up to them. I just want to go back to my normal life, a simple wannabe farmer. However, if I hear anything new, I will write in an update. Just between us, I hope it turns out to be nothing. If it is what I think it is, it means somebody got away with 42 murders and was never punished for it. That is perhaps the most terrifying thing. This was the incident that taught me you can never truly know someone, even after 20 years. When I was about 5 years old, I was shipped off to a kindergarten. At the time, I was a very shy and quiet girl. I was standing off by myself when this chubby little boy approached me. We will call him Sonny for the story. Sonny began talking to me and mentioned his family owned a farm close to mine. I was curious and asked which one. The two of us spoke together until nap time. We soon became good friends. On the weekends, one of us would ride our bikes over to each other's farm to play. Not many kids lived in the area, so it was just us most of the time. By middle school, we were like siblings. He was even my first kiss, although it meant nothing to either one of us. Early in high school, we would date other people and see other people at parties. I do not think either one of us ever thought of each other in anything more than platonic terms. It stayed this way until our junior year. I was eager to go to prom, but no one had asked me. I heard Sonny did not have a date, so I asked him. He said yes, but as a favor to an old friend. On the night of the prom, some of our classmates rented a hotel room to party in. Both of us had way too much to drink and ended up making out. The next day, we talked about what had happened. It was ultimately decided that we should start dating, if nothing more than to make sure it was not the booze that caused our actions. For the rest of that year and the next, we continued dating. Things seemingly were going well. When the time came, we lost our V-cards together. It was special, but the relationship did not go on to be very intimate. We were basically the same friends we had always been. The only difference was that we never dated anyone else and occasionally had sex. Overall, it may have been the happiest time of my life. Sonny had always treated me well, and even then, when I left for college, he understood breaking up was for the best. We kept in touch, calling one another about once a month. This was how I found out he had started seeing one of our classmates. Rose was the same age as us and a nice girl. She stayed in town and was going to our local community college. When I visited for the holidays, I would hang out with them. They made a cute couple, and I said so. Rose's past, on the other hand, was not a happy one. From what I heard, she had been messed with as a child. This had done considerable damage to her psychological being, and she had attempted suicide at least once. In middle school, she was institutionalized. She returned our freshman year and seemed a lot happier. We all assumed her demons had been conquered and the self-harming behavior was in the past. This is why her disappearance and presumed suicide was such a disappointing thing to all who knew her. According to Sunny, they had had a fight over dinner or something else equally stupid. After this, she became gradually more and more disconnected. One afternoon, she was supposed to be on her way to his house but never showed up. He called around looking for her until finally reporting her missing the next morning. A county-wide search was undertaken, and her car was found parked at the rest stop beside one of our larger bridges. No sounds of foul play were discovered, so the case was ruled a probable suicide. I heard about it on Facebook and called Sunny to express my condolences. We only spoke briefly, and it was clear her death hit him hard. The next few years flew by fast. Before I knew it, I was graduating with no real prospects. I figured moving back home was my best option. Dad could always use an extra hand. Sonny's mother, his last remaining member, had passed the year before, prior to Rose. He inherited the farm and made a little money. He invested it in a few pigs and a bunch of chickens. By the time of my return, the chickens were paying off. There were these fancy free-range ones that were popular with upscale restaurants. They were smaller than usual, but unbelievably delicious. He and I began hanging out again, and soon discovered we still had feelings for each other. The relationship moved quickly until I was staying at his place almost every night. Meanwhile, at this same time, a new DA was elected, and she had reopened Rose's case, unknown to anyone. Nobody I know is aware of her reason, but it is not very important. What is that she had several powerful friends. With little more than a hunch, she had given the warrant to search his house. I was not around when it was executed. I had just got a job working with disabled children at a daycare. Sunny never mentioned it happened, let alone that they had found blood. Luminol had been sprayed in various rooms. The kitchen showed small amounts on the cabinets. However, the largest amount was found around the tub and the drain. I walked around completely oblivious for another 4 months. DNA test had confirmed all the blood samples belonged to Rose. Once again, I was working when Sunny was arrested. For some crazy reason, he did not ask for a lawyer immediately. He was doing well. He could have hired himself a great one. Instead, he let them grill him for hours. Maybe he thought he was smarter and could convince them they had messed up. If that was it, his hubris was his undoing. For over 4 hours, the cops hammered him. He always had a plausible reason for almost every question. Why was her blood in the kitchen? Well, maybe she cut her finger while preparing a meal. Why did we find so much blood in the shower and drain? Maybe she had a bloody nose. I wish she was here to tell you. This battle continued until one of the officers tried a new angle. Can you explain why you were seen driving Rose's car in the direction of the bridge that evening that she went missing, and then seen by the same person returning on foot the following morning? Well, I am paraphrasing, of course, but something like that was what tripped him up. No one had witnessed anything of the sort. Sunny did not know this, though. When he had no answers, they knew they had him and attacked. Soon after, he broke and admitted to killing her. They finally had the confession they needed, but one question remained. Where was Rose's body? Other than admitting he had dismembered her and disposed of her parts, the full story never reached the public. I only heard because I happened to be in a restaurant with a police officer involved in the case. He was a friend of ours, a few years older, and was having drinks with a group of us. He had a lot to drink. One of the guys had been nagging him for inside information all night, and that was when he spit it out. I personally wish I had never heard it. To be as brief as possible, after he had dismembered her body in the bathtub, he intended to bury the remains in one of the pastures. He thought it through and decided against it, mainly because he was afraid of coyotes or other scavengers. This was where our friend hesitated. Well, come on, man, don't be a tease, say it. We were all on the edge of our seats. The guy pushed harder. Our friend gulped the last of his beer and then blurted it out. He fed her to the pigs, man. Is that what you want to hear? Your friend, a girl who had never heard a fly, he chopped her up and fed her to his pigs. We were all struck dumb. It was the last thing I would have expected. I had had a hard enough time wrapping my head around my best friend being a murderer. But when I heard that, any shred of respect I still had for him melted away. This case had obviously affected everyone involved greatly. Even this young cop. A guy who had known Sonny, and most of us. A few seconds passed before he stood up and stormed off to get another drink. After being served, he sat alone at another table and cried for several minutes. I had been home from work for just a few minutes when he called. I told him I would head over after showering. I did not give him a chance to speak. Once I had shut up, he spoke calmly and quickly. I still remember every word. "I'm sorry, Sandy. I did something terrible. You and I are not going to see each other again. Thank you for being my friend. I will always love you. Goodbye." Then he hung up. I did not understand. I called his house right away and got no answer. None of it made any sense. He had never done as much as jaywalk in his life. Then Rose's death flashed in my head. What had he done? Why would he confess to something he did not do? I was so upset. I could not think straight. I think I was still crying when the news came on. I had not known about the DNA results. It was still almost impossible to believe he had done it. No reason was really stated, and I still do not think he has ever given one. Since he had confessed, the DA took the death penalty off the table. A deal was cut for life with possible parole after 30 years. I tried to talk to him at the hearing, but he just ignored me. After he had been led away, his lawyer handed me a note. It simply stated not to try to contact him. Move on and find someone who isn't a monster. Any hope I had crumbled in that courtroom. A friendship of over 20 years ended in the blink of an eye. The most important man in my life, bar my father. I had not gone over a month without talking to him since I was 5 years old. It has been a very hard loss to overcome, and I'm not sure I'll ever be able to trust someone like that again. This happened in the late 1980s. I was working at a seed and feed store in the northern United States one day. I happened to notice a post on our community bulletin board. It was for a job as a caretaker on a nearby farm. This had aroused my curiosity, so I had given them a call. The job turned out to only be temporary, which made it even more alluring. I'd been wanting to move back to Florida for some time, and the higher pay would make that possible, and sooner. The number on the posting belonged to the owner's children. They needed a caretaker to fill in for their elderly father. He had had a stroke the month prior, and it was expected it would take 6 to 9 months, possibly more, for him to rehabilitate. In the meantime, he would be living at a rehab facility, so they were looking for a single person, or a couple, to live on the farm. There was no crop to plant or harvest, only a pair of horses that required basic care and exercise whenever possible. I provided a brief list of my past jobs and a few references. They promised to get back to me, and hung up. It was almost a week until I heard from them again. They wanted to offer me the job. Naturally, I took it and moved in that weekend. The place was not much anything fancy. A modest, 3-bedroom home and a couple of large outbuildings built on 125 acres. My day consisted of mucking out the stalls and providing fresh food and water for the horses. When I finished that, a few times a week, I would saddle up one of them and go for a ride around the property. This was all before lunch. After, I would take some care of some little things that would need fixing. If there was not any work left, I would pass out in front of the TV until dinner. Overall, it was a pretty cushy job as far as farm work goes. The owner's kids would call or swing by on occasion, but I had the place to myself for the most part. I had been there around 7 months when my prep for lunch was interrupted by a pounding on the door. I answered it and was greeted by a swarm of guys in suits and FBI jackets. They had handed me some papers and said they had a warrant to search the property. I honestly had no idea what to say, so I told them the circumstances, and I had to call the owner's family. They seemed a bit miffed, but understood. I rang the family up and they told me to let them do their job and stay out of their way. They would contact their lawyer and they would handle it. I said okay and let them do their thing. They appeared to have been looking for something. house was left alone. Instead of searching any buildings, a truck with a trailer carrying a backhoe drove toward the back of the property. They passed out of my view and I returned to making my lunch. Cars came and went for the next few hours. I dozed back off in front of the TV. Later that day, I was awakened by ruckus out front. I peeked out the curtains and saw a swarm of news vans and cameras camped out on the front lawn. One of them saw me and shouted, "There he is!" I was still groggy and had no clue what was going on. A group of reporters and cameras rushed out toward the window. I jerked the curtain closed fast and returned to my post on the couch. I flipped through the channels until I caught sight of my house. What exactly was happening was not clear at first. I wiped the sweat from my eyes and turned up the volume. On the screen, an anchor was talking to another guy over the phone while footage of the farm was being shown. The man over the phone mentioned a guy who had disappeared some years prior. A member of the Mafia, supposedly. Then, footage switched to the helicopter view of the backfield. A bunch of the same FBI guys and some state officers were standing next to the Bobcat. Next to that, a big hole had been dug. The helicopter scanned over from the hole, and we saw two black bags laying next to one another on the ground. To anyone who has ever seen one, they were obviously body bags, and they looked to have bodies in them. My jaw must have been dragging on the floor. I felt drool rolling down my chin and wiped it away. I was freaking out. What the hell have I gotten myself into? I needed some answers, and I needed them now. I called the family back and told them what was going on. They said they were aware, but not to worry about it. I was not in any danger, legally or otherwise. I was told to stay in the house and not to talk to the media. They had been notified I was not involved in any way, and should be leaving soon. None of this made me feel any better, though, but there was not much I could do, at least at that moment. I hung up and went back to watching the news coverage. As the hours grounded on, the story became clearer. The bodies belonged to two mob guys who had disappeared a few years earlier. The scariest part of the revelation, though, a nice old man who owned the farm was a longtime mob associate. The entire mess had me twisted in knots. I tossed and turned the whole night. I could not decide whether to quit or stay on for the remainder. The world of organized crime was foreign to me, and something I had no desire to be involved in. On the other hand, this was my dream job. I had been treated well and seen no sign of criminal activity. Even as I dialed the phone that morning, I was not sure what I would say. However, the moment they answered, my mouth made the choice for me. I said I was calling them to let them know I was giving my 1 week's notice. Any longer was just out of the question. While my time at the farm was wonderful, the recent events were playing on my mind heavily. The owner's daughter who answered, she tried to talk me out of quitting, but I guess she could tell I was afraid. She quickly relented and thanked me for doing such a great job. I briefly felt a tinge of guilt, but my brain took over. I thanked her and we ended the call. The media had eventually moved on, so I was free to finish my week in peace. The feds must have gotten all they needed that first day because there was no sign of them after that. I rode one of the horses down to the gravesite the next morning, mainly out of curiosity. The hole had been filled in, and other than some tire tracks, the area looked rather normal. I don't know what I was expecting. I soon lost interest and returned to the stables. The morning I moved out, the owner's kids showed up to give me the rest of my pay and said goodbye. They were going to stay at the house until they found a replacement. I recommended a few people and provided their numbers. We made some small talk until I loaded the last of my things. They wished me good luck, and I pulled away. I pointed my truck south toward Florida and arrived a few days later. I've been here ever since. I had intended on ending it here, but I realized some of you may be wondering what became of the case. Well, the fact is I had no clue until I read up on it prior to writing this. It appears nothing would happen for a long time. The feds had some suspects, but no one was really talking. Then, just after the new millennium began, they got the witnesses they needed. A slew of gangsters involved was convicted and will likely die in prison. The family who owned the farm, I have no idea what became of them. The job was great and they treated me well, but that is where it all ends for me. Behind closed doors, they were into some very crooked stuff. Stuff I did not want to be roped into. I am a simple fella, and my family and my life has been great since. I do not regret leaving that place for a single second. thanks for listening to these creepy and allegedly true farming horror stories sent in by viewers just like you. As always, if you have a story that you would like to share in a future video, whether it's a farming story or something else, be sure to submit it at swampdweller.net or the email you can find in the description down below. I'd love to share your story with everyone here in the swamp. It's stories like yours that truly help keep this show going on a daily basis. If you enjoyed these stories, please be sure to hit that like button as it helps me out a ton. If you're listening on iTunes or another podcast platform, be sure to give this a 5-star rating as it helps me out even more. If you're new to the swamp, why not join us? Hit that subscribe button and turn on notifications to never miss a new video, as I upload them almost every single day, and all things natural and supernatural. If you're on the go and you still want to listen to your favorite Swamp Dweller scary stories, but you don't have YouTube Premium, you can download them absolutely free from iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, and just about any other podcast platform. And like I said, it's absolutely free and always will be. If you would like to support the Swamp outside of hitting that like button and subscribing, maybe check out the merch store. I've got t-shirts, face masks, hoodies, and just about everything else. Thank you guys, as always, for supporting the Swamp the way you do. Before we end this video, I'd love to know in the comments down below what story you like the best tonight. Also, I'd love to know what makes you the most scared when you're home alone. I'll see you guys soon with another creepy video.